Welcome to the Science Podcast for August 16th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Linda Poon. This week, we bring you stories from our special issue on pesticides, including preventing pesticide suicides, manipulating the plant immune system, and using RNAi technology to tackle serious pests.
This is sometimes called the billion-dollar pest because in the U.S. alone, it can lead to losses of around $1 billion.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Though not a well-known problem in the Western world, pesticide ingestion accounts for roughly one-third of suicides globally, and it's most prevalent in rural parts of Asia. Science's contributing editor Mara Fistendahl reports on Sri Lanka, where the suicide rate spiked in the 70s during the Green Revolution, when farmers and their families had easy access to potent insecticides. When a ban on some of the most toxic groups of pesticides solved only part of the problem in the early to mid-90s, biologist Fleming Conradson and his team designed a simple lockbox in hopes that it would reduce the number of suicides by keeping chemicals out of the hands of desperate people. I spoke with Fistendahl about the ongoing 5-year study to test the effectiveness of these lockboxes and what the results are so far.
So during the Green Revolution, farmers in Asia started using new varieties of plants that required intensive agriculture. And that led to heavy use of pesticides. And so organic chlorines and organic phosphates in particular became widely available. And these are very, very potent chemicals that many people have still in their homes. And once it became available, the suicide rate just shot up. In Sri Lanka, which my story focuses on, many hospital beds in the 1990s were occupied by people who poison themselves with pesticides.
So is it just Sri Lanka, or is it, you know, in the region of Asia generally?
So this is a problem in China, India, other parts of the world as well. And pesticides are estimated to account for roughly a third of suicides globally. And within the Asian countries where they're used for suicide, they're by far the most common means. And it's something that pretty much everybody is aware of, and it's very visible in communities.
So why is pesticide ingestion so much more prevalent in Asia than it is in the West?
So it mainly has to do with the abundance of small plots of land in Asia. So the fact that many people have just a small field, maybe in the backyard, where they're growing some vegetables and will have chemicals that they keep maybe in the cupboard in their homes just for use on that plot of land. Whereas in the West, industrial agriculture means that relatively few people have access to pesticides. And one researcher I interviewed for the story told me that in the U.S., people have guns. In countries like Sri Lanka, they have pesticides.
Mm-hmm. So given how common this issue is in Asia, I mean, you said it accounts for one-third of the suicides globally. Why hasn't it received much attention both in that region and around the world?
Well, there's obviously a lot of activism around pesticides, but it's mostly focused on environmental hazards and on occupational exposure. And until recently, it really didn't look at the issue of people poisoning themselves with the chemicals. What the scientists I interviewed told me was that it's a difficult thing to get environmental activists excited about because they're trying to draw attention to pesticide producers, and it's really hard to do that when a product is misused, so when people are using it for reasons that are obviously not its intentions.
Mm-hmm. So one solution that Sri Lanka has tried is to phase out the use of hazard class 1 pesticide and then also ban class 2 pesticide. So how did that work out?
The suicide rate plummeted after the bans were put in place. And this was in the 1980s and 90s that Sri Lanka started addressing the problem. the suicide rate dropped 50% between 1995 and 2005. And it wasn't that people stopped poisoning themselves because they were still getting sick from ingesting chemicals, but more ended up in the hospital. And researchers actually take that to be a good sign. It meant that they were taking less potent pesticides, which they could survive exposure to, and that made a huge difference in the number of people who were dying.
So after that, Fleming Conradson and his team looked into using lockboxes. So what were the challenges of coming up with an effective design?
Well, so after the suicide rate dropped, it didn't go down completely to where it had been before the Green Revolution. And there were researchers who felt like more needed to be done. Fleming Conradson and his team, who's working with local organizers as well, they got the idea of locking pesticides up in some kind of contraption that could be stored in a safe place. But there were a lot of issues with doing this that they didn't foresee. So they first made a version out of wood that was popular with bees and termites. Then there was one out of cement that led to a lot of broken bottles. There was one with a kind of flimsy plastic lid that got trampled by elephants, and the lids would get stuck on the elephant's feet. So it was a lot of trial and error before they found the box that really worked.
So what was this final design?
The one they came up with is a waterproof, UV-resistant lockbox. It has two containers, so one inside the other, so that the lock doesn't get rusted.
So how did they test the effectiveness of this new design that they came up with?
So now these researchers are overseeing a huge trial involving over 220,000 people in Sri Lanka to address the question of whether lockboxes really are effective at reducing suicide attempts and successful suicides. Mm-hmm. So they'll be charting over 5 years how the boxes are used and then whether there's actually a drop in the number of people trying to harm themselves. So if putting the chemicals in these boxes is helpful in that way. And they say the question isn't fully resolved at all, and that's the reason for doing a randomized trial.
And what were the results?
So far the results have been mixed. Some people, when they get a box, they'll bring the chemicals closer to home. In other cases, after a while, studies would find that people were leaving their boxes unlocked. So the rate of proper use really declined over time. And in the current study, there have been a few cases where people have actually broken into the boxes to get the chemicals.
So the lockbox still needs a lot of work. And part of the reason is because suicide is an issue that needs to be tackled from several different angles. So what else needs to be addressed in order for these lockboxes to be effective?
Well, the researchers that I worked with for this story really feel strongly that the primary focus in looking at suicide through pesticide ingestion in Asia should be banning these chemicals. Sri Lanka is actually unique in Asia in having enforced bans on some of the most potent pesticides because countries like China and India have domestic pesticide industries that are active in lobbying against bans. And in Sri Lanka, that wasn't the case, and so it was a little easier to push them through. But they'd like to see similar things done elsewhere, and then lockboxes could be kind of a supplement to that.
Hmm. Okay, well, Mara Fistendahl, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thanks for having me on the podcast.
Mara Fistendahl writes on locking up pesticides to prevent suicides in this week's special issue.
How smart can pest control be? How about selecting which bug to repel by its genetic code? As part of this week's special issue on pesticides, Kai Kupferschmidt investigated a technique that uses RNA interference to target specific pests for self-destruction.
RNAi is a really clever mechanism that probably evolved to defend against viruses. So many viruses have a genome that's made up of double-stranded RNA, and when this RNA gets into the cell, it gets cut into smaller pieces by cellular machinery, And then the cell uses these little bits of RNA to go searching for other copies of the same gene and then destroys it. So basically, the cell goes fishing for other copies of the virus to destroy all of the virus copies.
How can you use this mechanism where the cell, its machinery goes looking for specific pieces of RNA and then destroys them? How can that be used as an insecticide or a pesticide?
The basic idea is that you present to the cell a piece of RNA that is actually the genetic sequence of a gene that the cell itself has. So if you do that, you actually turn the cell against itself and the cell starts to destroy all of the transcripts of the gene that you presented to it. That's how researchers first found RNAi, because they introduced a gene to make petunias more purple, but instead the flowers became whiter. And that's because the plant actually started destroying the copies of the transcripts of the gene that produced this pigment.
So that's in plants. How would you get it into an insect?
The surprising thing is that many insects actually take up this RNA from the gut. You just have to feed them the RNA, and it gets taken up by cells in the gut, and then somehow the cells lining the gut actually spread the signal throughout the whole body. So if you present them a piece of their own DNA as double-stranded RNA, the animals will take that up and cells in the whole body will start destroying transcript of that particular gene.
Wow, but that doesn't happen in, say, us. So how come it's so different in the insect system?
Well, nobody really knows what the specific reasons are. I mean, some insects are more susceptible to this than others. And it seems, for example, that insects that produce a lot of saliva, they're a lot less susceptible to this simply because there are certain substances in the saliva that break down RNA. And that's also apparently what happens in human beings. So in human beings, you have saliva in the mouth, and then you also have the acidic pH in the stomach. So you have a lot of barriers that keep the RNA from actually getting into our cells.
So we can eat as much RNA as we want.
Yeah, and we do every day. I mean, there's RNA in everything that we eat.
Right. So can you give us an example or two of the kinds of insects that are getting targeted with this RNAi method?
Right. So the one that's closest to commercialization is a plant that was developed by Monsanto, and they are targeting the Western corn rootworm. That's a beetle whose larvae feed on the roots of corn plants. And it's actually a very big nuisance to farmers. So this is sometimes called the billion-dollar pest, because in the U.S. alone, it can lead to losses of around $1 billion. That's probably the plant that's going to be the first one to be on the market.
So, yeah, actually, that's my next question. How close is this technology to the market? Has it been field-tested anywhere?
Yes, so the Monsanto plant, for example, is actually finished, and they're just going through the regulatory process now of approval. So they're waiting for it to be approved, and one of the people at Monsanto told me that by the end of this decade, they expect this to be, you know, on the field in farms.
So in this case, it would be the plant is expressing an RNA, the insect target takes that up, and then it basically kills itself by tearing up that RNA in its own body.
Exactly. And the clever thing is that, first of all, only insects who actually eat off the plant will come into contact with the RNA. And also, you can make the plant express this RNA only in the roots, for instance, if you're talking about larvae that feed on the roots. So you can be a lot more specific with this than with some other technologies, that, like just spraying pesticides.
And it also has specificity in terms of the pest, right? You can be a little selective there.
Exactly. It is a lot easier with this. So in the past, often chemicals were used, and it's very difficult to engineer a chemical in such a way that it will kill a certain type of caterpillar, say, but not a different one. Now, with this technology, it's really just a question of finding a genetic sequence that is important to this particular animal, but not to other animals, and then designing the RNA to copy that piece of genetic sequence.
So that sounds like a big step up in terms of its selectivity. What other benefits might this new technology in pest control bring?
Well, the main benefit is probably that people hope this will be more specific and it will lead to less pesticides being used. But at the same time, people are hoping that it might be harder for insects to develop resistance against this. Now, that is something that we cannot know in advance, but certainly insects would have to have mutations in several parts of the gene that's being targeted in order to develop resistance against this. So there is some hope that there'll be a high barrier against developing resistance.
Okay. Well, controversy tends to follow genetically modified organisms around, be they plant or animal. Will critics be able to make the same objections that they do to what's out there now, that it might escape into the wild or have unintended consequences on other organisms?
Yes, I think in many ways we'll see a rehash of the kind of debates that we've had about other genetically engineered plants. Of course, with all the benefits that we've talked about, people will point to that, but at the same time, people will be afraid that this kind of plant, this kind of RNA, if it can kill insects, why can it not get into humans and change how our genes are expressed? I think that's the kind of debate we'll probably be seeing, and there is actually one scientific paper as well that showed that some small RNAs can be found in the blood of humans, and there's a lot of debate about whether that's a real finding or not, but certainly already some groups who are opposed to this kind of genetically engineered plants are using that paper to attack it.
So what are the methods, besides genetically modifying the food of the insects, that researchers suggested might work for this technology, is to actually spray crops with RNA. How feasible is that? Would that work on a large scale?
Well, first of all, I think many people are hoping that it would work on a large scale because it would solve a few problems. You'd kind of pass by the whole controversy about genetically engineered plants. And also, it would be a lot easier to adapt this if, say, you have a new pathogen or the pest becomes resistant to something. You could just change the DNA. You wouldn't have to breed a whole new plant. You could just change the RNA that you're spraying on the plants. So I think a lot of people are hoping this might work, but there's also a lot of criticism because RNA is a fairly unstable molecule. So the question is, how long would this actually be on the plants? How long would it be active? How often would you have to spray it? At the same time, some people I talked to said, well, at the moment, farmers are basically equipped to spray things on plants. That is how most of crop protection is done. So you could use all of this available equipment with it, which would be another argument for trying it this way. I think a lot of people will look at whether the RNA is stable enough and how fast it will be degraded, and it might be different from depending on the soil that you're growing certain plants in and whether you're adding this to the water or whether you're actually spraying it on the leaves of the plant.
And is it cost-effective to make up RNA and then spray it on a field?
That's probably one of the biggest problems at the moment. So RNA is fairly expensive to make in large quantities. So at the moment, it seems more feasible to just let the plant produce it. That would be a lot more cost effective. But of course, we've seen a large drop in the cost of synthesizing DNA as well. And we could see the same in RNA. So you never know what might happen in a few years.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kai Kupferschmidt, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Kai Kupferschmidt writes about a new way to tackle pests as part of this week's special issue. You can read his article, more news, reviews, and commentary, all on making smarter pesticides at www.sciencemag.org/special/pesticides.
When microbes value our food plants as much as we do, protecting crops from pathogens becomes problematic. Despite copious use of pesticides, 15% of global crop production is lost to pre-harvest plant disease. However, a deeper study of how plants defend themselves against these pests and pathogens may be a saving grace for global food security and sustainable farming. Jeff Dengel discusses what efforts are being made to re-engineer plant immunity, making plants less susceptible to disease and therefore less in need of pesticides.
Plant pathogens, fungi, oomycetes, bacteria, and viruses cause lots of damage to our plants and to our crops. They cause that damage in many cases after the water has been spent to grow the crop, so plant diseases are water losses as well. And it's very clear that as we need to feed more and more people on less land with less chemicals, that we're going to need to know how the plant immune system works and how we as biologists and plant breeders can help it work better.
For some background on this topic, can you describe a plant's immune system?
The plant immune system is actually extremely sophisticated. If you think about it, plants have a problem. They can't run away and hide. They're stuck in one place for their entire life. And so this means they have to be able to sense their environment very carefully, both the abiotic environment, light, soil nutrients, water, and also the biotic environment. So a plant can't avoid being bombarded by fungal pathogens or having bacteria migrate to its roots through the soil. So a plant has to be able to have a very exquisite surveillance system at all times. And the other constraint that animal immunologists probably wouldn't consider, plants have no circulating cells, so that the surveillance system has to function, in essence, in every cell, in every tissue, because any of those cells might be the target of an evolved microbe. The plant immune system has to tell the difference between a commensal or mutualist or symbiotic microbe and a dangerous microbe.
So, essentially, the plant needs to tell a difference between friend and foe at the molecular level. How, then, does a pathogen reprogram a plant's gene expression patterns to increase its own fitness?
So, successful pathogens have evolved ways to block or dampen or suppress that pattern recognition receptor-mediated defense response. They do this by delivering proteins to the inside of the plant cell. Pretty astounding, actually, that everything from bacteria, fungi, oomycetes, aphids, and nematodes, which are all major classes of plant pathogens, have evolved independently ways to deliver proteins to the inside of a plant cell. Once inside the plant cell, those proteins, which we call effector proteins, they do things to plant host machinery that makes the environment better for the pathogen. And so the first issue is they suppress the ongoing defense response. They also, secondly, can make the plant produce proteins that provide nutrients to the outside the cell organism, to the microbe that's living in between plant cells. And finally, they can also help the pathogen disperse. So there's a huge diversity, a wonderful and fascinating diversity of effector proteins made by all classes of plant pathogens that essentially slow down or block the first layer of the plant's immune system. So obviously, if that were true, then there'd be no food and no resistant plants because the pathogens would win. So the plants have evolved a second tier of receptors that actually act inside the cell to sense the molecules that the pathogens deliver inside the cell. And these molecules are called nucleotide binding leucine rich repeat receptors, or NLR for short. So once the NLR receptor senses the presence of a specific effector protein, then the output system is rebooted and plant defense response goes forward to stop pathogen growth. So you can imagine that this game goes back and forth over and over again.
So unlike humans, plants don't have immune cells just circulating around looking for infections. Rather, each cell has disease-resistance proteins in order to combat infection. So what are scientists doing to locate and investigate these genes?
The paradigm so far has been we use genetics to make a genetic map by crossing a resistant parent and a susceptible parent and challenging it with pathogen. And then in the last 20 years, people have been able to use genomics-based tools to do positional cloning of disease-resistance genes. But this, as you can imagine, requires very good genomics resources in the target species. And so the great unsung heroism of the last 25 years in plant biology has been that we now have genomics kits for a huge majority of the most important crop species. And one of the great applications of those genomics kits is to the isolation of disease resistance genes.
In terms of combating plant pathogens and food security, can you give an example where adding these disease-resistance genes might prove useful?
Crop disease has been a problem for a long time in a lot of places around the world. The one that most of your readers and listeners are likely to be familiar with is the potato late blight epidemic in Ireland in the 1840s, which caused millions of people to be uprooted and many of them emigrated to the U.S. Millions of people died. And so that late blight pathogen is called Phytophthora infestans. Phytophthora is still a major disease in tomatoes and peppers and potatoes. In Europe, for example, where people grow and eat lots of potatoes, it's very difficult to control Phytophthora, even to this day. It's done so by chemicals that nobody likes. Those chemicals were mostly listed for being banned in the EU many years ago. They're given a year-by-year reprieve because there's simply no other solution. So that's one real-world example where isolation of disease resistance genes from wild potatoes or relatives of potatoes would be a perfect case where a genetically modified potato would replace the use of pretty nasty chemicals.
Right. So although we're talking about changes at the micro level, it can have macro level consequences. How is this method of developing disease resistance an environmentally sustainable option?
It's imperative that we grow our food in a sustainable way and that we do so with less chemical input. The example I gave earlier, late blight in potato, in Europe, there are currently anywhere from 25 to 50 sprayings. And so if you could reduce that by tenfold, down to two or three sprays per season with a genetic solution, I think that's a huge win for environmentalists. In fact, it's hard to be an environmentalist and not embrace genetically modified technology for trading in genetic technology for chemical use. So I think this is a hugely important issue.
Then what are some of the challenges of implementing the next generation of disease-resistance crop? Because it is increasing the plant's immunity and it is environmentally sustainable, but are there consumer anxieties or regulatory hurdles?
I think there are both. To register a transgenic plant in the U.S. takes many millions of dollars and many years to get through the regulatory process. So the regulatory burden is quite high. But this technology in general around disease resistance is aimed squarely at replacing chemical use. And I think that the best way to do it at large scale is by careful deployment of mixed genotypes of different disease resistances. We're now at a point where we understand the immune system in plants enough to be able to think about and propose and carry through real translational experiments and translational research programs.
Okay, well, Jeff Dangle, thank you for talking with me.
All right, Christy, thank you.
Jeff Dangle writes about manipulating plant immune systems in this week's special issue of Science.
Finally today, we have David Grimm, online news editor for Science. He's here to give us a rundown on some of the recent stories from our daily news site. I'm Christy Hamilton. So, Dave, first up, we have a story on probing so-called near-death experiences in the brain. Some people have experienced these moments as floating above their body, watching themselves from outside. How did scientists go about studying the brain during the brink of death?
Well, they couldn't study humans for obvious reasons, so they turned to rodents, specifically rats. And they anesthetized a bunch of rats, and they induced cardiac arrest, which essentially shut off their heart. And then they probed what their brain activity was between that last heartbeat and when the rats actually died. And they saw some pretty interesting stuff.
So what did they find?
Well, what they saw was actually used an EEG, which is an electrocephalogram, and these EEGs revealed a highly organized brain response in the seconds after cardiac arrest. It didn't seem like random brain activity. It actually seemed like there was some sort of conscious thought going on. And what they saw specifically were oscillations in the low gamma frequency, which previous human research has linked these gamma waves to waking consciousness, meditative states, and even REM sleep. So you can think about potentially dreaming. They also saw what they called top-down signaling in the brain activity of these rats, which is associated in humans with conscious perception and information processing. This increased eightfold compared to the waking state of these animals. And when you put all this together, it suggests that the dying brain is hyperactive in its final seconds. It's producing meaningful conscious activity, at least in these rats, and if the same holds true for people, could help explain a lot of the near-death experiences people have.
So is there any indication that what the rats are experiencing is the same things that humans experience as well?
Well, that's the billion-dollar question. We really have no idea what's going on in the brain of any animal, much less an animal that's having a near-death experience. So even though we're seeing this highly organized brain activity, we really have no way to say that these rats are seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, that they're seeing all their dead rat relatives. we just don't know what's going on. So that's really the big black hole here is even though researchers are seeing what looks like highly organized brain activity, we really don't know what's going on in the minds of these creatures.
So are humans next?
Well, that's a good question, too. And what the researchers say is they could actually start monitoring brain activity in people undergoing brain surgery that involves cooling the brain and reducing the blood supply to the brain. This procedure has produced near-death experiences in the past, so it might be a good way to show that if people are having these experiences and the researchers can link up specific brain activity with those experiences, that they could show that there actually is a scientific basis for near-death experiences.
All right. Next up, we have a story on why we shouldn't trust the internet. I already don't trust the internet, but now researchers have given us some evidence for why not.
That's right. And it's not necessarily just the internet as a global thing, but more specifically, reviews on the internet. Whether it's Amazon or Yelp or whatever, we're always, a lot of us look at reviews on the internet. We put a lot of faith in them, whether it's to buy a product or potentially go to a restaurant. This study suggests that these reviews are highly subject to manipulation, so you might not want to trust those reviews as much as you think you can.
So how do they go about testing this then?
Well, what they did was they actually looked at a news site, a real-world site that aggregates news stories, and then readers can comment on the news stories, and then users can actually review those comments. So the comments that get a lot of positive reviews tend to go up in visibility, where those that get a lot of negative reviews tend to go down in visibility. And what the researchers said is, can we manipulate this? Can we get people to be more positive about a comment or potentially even more negative about a comment by sort of gaming the system?
And could they?
They could. And what they found was that if they, at least they could halfway, that was true, actually. What they found was that if they gamed some of the comments, so they gave them a lot of upvotes, that users were 32% more likely to also give a positive vote to that comment. They didn't see the same thing with negative votes. If they put a lot of negative votes on a comment, that didn't necessarily make other users want to also put a negative vote on that comment. And the researchers think that has a lot to do with human psychology, that people are more skeptical of what they call negative social influence, but that they're more willing to go along with positive opinions from other people.
So what does this all mean then?
Well, it means that you might not want to trust some of those comments on the internet, especially if they're positive comments. The applications for companies are a little less clear. Researchers have shown that if users feel that a company is manipulating a rating online, they're much less likely to trust it.
Finally, we have a story on bone-eating worms found in Antarctic waters. So what can you tell us about these bone worms?
Well, they are worms that eat bones, hence their name. They're actually technically known as ossidacts, and they've only been known since about 2004. And these are really strange creatures. You actually can see a picture of them on the site. Basically, what they look like is they are thread-like worms. They vary from about 0.6 millimeters to 15 millimeters in length. They are mouthless and gutless, yet they're still able to feed on the skeletons of dead animals, including whales, birds, fish, and even cows, assuming they sink to the bottom of the sea. And previous studies have shown that they actually are pretty widely spread throughout the world, but we didn't know until this new study they're actually also found in Antarctica.
So if they don't have mouths, how do they eat bone?
That is a great question. And what they do is they form large colonies of elongated females and in these reddish wavy plumes that function as gills, while their greenish root-like structures release an acid that enables them to tunnel into the bone. And again, you should really check out a picture. These guys are really freaky looking.
So how are bone worms different to shipworms?
So shipworms are another really weird ocean creature, and they're actually not worms despite their name. They're actually mollusks, and they were first found in the 1700s because they were devouring wooden pilings the Dutch used to protect their lowlands from flooding. These are naked cylindrical creatures which bear a pair of tiny shells at one end of their bodies that they use to grind into wood, and then they actually digest that wood. And you can actually see a picture of these guys too on the site. And they have also been found pretty widely throughout the world.
Okay, so what did the researchers find in this study then?
Well, what the researchers did, which was really kind of cool and kind of crazy, was they outfitted these two old deep sea landers, which are these platforms that are designed to carry equipment and other materials to the sea floor, and they loaded them up with wooden planks and whale bones. And what they were hoping to find, and they basically dropped them to the bottom of the ocean, and what they were hoping to find was whether they would find shipworms and bone worms in Antarctic waters, which is where they put some of these skeletons. And lo and behold, when they pulled the whale bones back up, they were covered in bone worms. But when they pulled up the wood, they didn't find any shipworms.
So what does this all mean?
Well, what it all means for bone worms is that they are very widely spread throughout the world, even in Antarctic waters, which is pretty cool. What it means for shipworms is that they don't appear to be in Antarctic waters, and there's sort of a nice silver lining for that because there are a lot of potentially very famous shipwrecks off the coast of Antarctica. For example, the famous Antarctic explorer Ernest Shackleton, his ship Endurance sank in 1915 in western Antarctic waters, and what's great about potentially not having shipworms in these waters is these shipworms wreak havoc, as you might expect, on shipwrecks because they eat the wood. So it suggests that there may be a lot of famous shipwrecks that still may be down there in the waters off Antarctica.
So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, speaking of wood, we've got a story about how scientists are trying to take wood out of the equation when it comes to creating biofuels of the future. Also a story about the supermassive black hole in the center of our Milky Way galaxy and some new insights into why it's not eating as much as it should be eating. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about why activists have destroyed a genetically modified rice field in the Philippines. Also a story about whether a White House science committee needs an ethical review. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Christy.
David Grimm is the editor of Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
And that concludes the August 16, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Linda Poon.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.